Ask me down judiciary come to order. Today is March 5th, 2015. We're going to go out of order. The first, we're going to go on one bill. We're going to go down to the bottom and take House Bill 2915. Representative Fagan, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2915 comes to us at the request of the Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. The bill establishes a credit against personal income taxes for purchases of qualifying gun safes. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st of 2015 and before January 1st of 2017. The bill takes effect on the 91st day following sine die. There is a minimal fiscal impact and a revenue light impact with a subsequent referral to revenue.
Thank you, Representative.
Go ahead. Oh, sure. Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name's Craig Roberts with Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and I'm here today to support the bill to increase gun safety in favor of House Bill 2915. When we talk about firearm safety, I think any one of us can pick up a local newspaper, look on the internet of a national tragedy about an unsecured firearm across this country. I want to tell you, in Clackamas County, you may recall the tragedy that we had at the Clackamas Town Center. In 2012, you might recall that the firearm in that situation was actually stolen from a friend of the suspect that was unsecured in his home on that particular situation. So when we talk about gun safety, we know that hiding a gun in a closet is really not adequate for a barrier against misuse. But I also want to tell you about a tragedy along those lines that I was personally involved in as a detective that actually still really haunts me today. And this was a case of a 9-year-old boy named Brandon Rose. He was actually watching after his 2-year-old sibling. They were all home alone. He found his dad's rifle and found some bullets in the house that was in his older brother's room. On that particular day, Brandon actually shot and killed his 6-year-old sister, Charlotte, who at that time, I would tell you, was so tragic that she, after being mortally wounded, crawled down a hallway trying to get to her bed, thinking that things would get better if she got into bed. So I think that obviously these types of situations happen more frequently than any of us, I think, want. And I thought the comment made by Brandon, who actually was responsible for taking the life of his sister, said this as an adult. Looking back, Brandon said, the gun itself really wasn't the problem. The problem was that I was able to have access to it. So the day I actually bought a gun, Brandon is saying this, is that he also bought a gun safe. So I believe it's really imperative that every gun owner that has an arm, firearms, and is willing to maintain one, that the common sense thing to do is to secure it safely in a gun safe. So thank you much for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Shamia Fagan for House District 51. Appreciate you hearing the bill today. My husband and I are both gun owners, both hunting rifles, and we also have handguns for personal protection. But we also started our family a few years ago, and before that had the guns kind of unsecured in the house. And obviously, with the responsibility of becoming parents, decided that it was time to step up and purchase gun safes. And this was actually quite a fun event for my husband to go to Costco with the charge of getting to purchase both large gun safes for the rifles and then smaller handgun safes for the guns that are in our bedroom. And not as fun for me when he brought home the Costco receipt and I realized how unbelievably expensive gun safes are. But you know, that's the responsibility, I believe, of as being a responsible gun owner. And so, you know, we went through with that. And then I remember going to a briefing with Sheriff Roberts for right before I came into my session after my first reelection, or excuse me, my first election, and hearing about the Clackamas Town Center shooting, which happened in my community, and about how the gun had simply been stolen because it was sitting in a bookshelf. And at that point, I was looking for this tragedy occurred literally, I think, a month or so before we started our session in the 2013 session. So I was looking for a practical way to bring Republicans and Democrats together, people who usually are very polarized on this particular issue, to say, is there something, anything practical we can do to move towards, you know, gun safety? And so I sponsored this bill, and actually at that time took the time to go around and gather, and it was the exact same bill, co-sponsors from Representative Sal Esquivel to Representative Alyssa Kinney Geyer, which I think we can recognize are probably the two polar opposites as you could possibly have on this issue. Both co-sponsored this bill. It doesn't mandate the purchase of a gun safe. It simply allows people who own a firearm, in particular maybe people who are lower income, people who are younger that have had a firearm handed down to them or given to them, that maybe don't have the means to go out and spend $500 to go purchase a gun safe, to be able to have an incentive to do that. So what the bill does is creates a tax credit for the purchase of a qualifying gun safe, and we worked closely with Cabela's and Dick's Sporting Goods to, you know, kind of look at really the gun safes that are out there to make sure that we're talking about a really secure gun safe, not maybe a, you know, kind of display case with a glass front that can easily be accessed, but one that actually secures the firearm. And we actually have reduced the credit to only be for tax filers who have a taxable income of less than $100,000, and even open to making that further. What we're really trying to get at is the folks that maybe couldn't otherwise afford to go buy a gun safe, or maybe it would be a real hardship. So what the tax credit does is it allows you to be reimbursed for up to $100 for 50% of the cost of the safe, which, you know, if you, for $100, you could definitely buy a decent gun safe for $200 and be able to get $100 of that back, which would make this a lot more affordable for people that want to be responsible gun owners. Now, I do want to add, for the purpose of testimony, that even though it was this group of very bipartisan co-sponsors when I filed it last time, and this time nobody said no, I just simply didn't have the time to go around and gather the same co-sponsors, but it's the same bill. We started then getting emails from people toward late in the session that had the belief that this was actually a conspiracy to try and get information and have some sort of record of people who are gun owners. So for the record, that certainly was not the intention. I don't think Sal Esquivel would have co-sponsored it had it been. And just to make that point, this is 100% voluntary. So if somebody did not want to, you know, have any, the government to have any information that they owned a firearm, you know, great, don't take advantage of the tax credit. That's absolutely fine. And certainly the point that I would make back to the people who'd be emailing me saying, you know, emailing me at my state rep account, which is a public record, saying, I don't want you to know I have a gun, I'd say, well, you just email the state representative and your email is public record. So if you're that concerned about people, you know, if this was a big conspiracy, maybe you wouldn't want to email a state representative with an email that's a public record. So again, totally voluntary, simply to encourage people who maybe otherwise couldn't afford to purchase a gun safe to be able to do so. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions you have.
Are there any questions from anybody? Representative Krieger.
Not really maybe a question, but you know, I was reading this when I first got here. Establishes credit against personal taxes for purchasing a qualified gun. I had my finger over safe. Well, you were really excited.
That is Representative Esquivel's bill.
No, but this has been an issue, Mr. Chair, for a long time. You know, my rural culture, none of the guns were secured in the home where I was raised. But from the time before I could walk, we knew you weren't to touch those things. And the Eddie Eagle program that teaches kids what to do, the NRA has got that program out. You don't see those rural kids in those homes getting involved in the even accidental type shootings as much. I don't see anything wrong with the bill myself. Anything we can do to keep guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them, whether it be someone that's stolen a gun or from juveniles, I think that's good.
Representative Post.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I'm with Representative Krieger. In our home, we have a safe. We always have. My son's 22 now, and it's all he's ever known. Being a guy who likes to jones the system as much as I can, great question. Is there a limit? In other words, if I have four guns, four safes, or one gun, one safe, does it matter on the credits? Just purely because, you know, I'm looking for all the tax credits I can possibly get.
It's up to $100 total for tax filer. So certainly, I mean, I think the handgun safe that we, well, I think it probably, I think the smaller one we have is a handgun safe, which is about $200. So that would right there maximize the credit. The reason, I mean, I'd certainly be open. In fact, I think the original bill that I sponsored was like a refundable tax credit of $500. But that was, the fiscal was so enormous, it made it where it was just impossible to get through the building. So that's why this is more pared back to make it a palatable enough, a small enough fiscal impact so that we could actually, you know, actually hopefully get it passed. But as written, it's a maximum amount, but I think it's by, let's see, but a combined total claim by the taxpayer in the tax year to not exceed 100. So as written, if you bought two $100 safes, as written, you could claim the full $100 tax credit by combining the cost of those, because it's $100 per taxpayer.
Okay, great.
Representative, do you have an estimate how many, well, what the revenue impact will be? How many people might use this in a year?
I don't have that with me. We're working on getting a fiscal impact right now. I think if I recall correctly from last session when I had the much broader, revenue impact, I apologize, revenue impact, I remember that at that time we had it as a refundable tax credit, which that's why the fiscal was so enormous. It was like $5 million, because they just said it was so hard to, the revenue impact was so difficult to determine how many people would use it. And when we had that refundable piece, which as a policy matter, I think is actually better policy, because you're capturing people who might, be in such a low income, they don't even have a taxable income. But again, that made the revenue impact so enormous that it was just kind of unpalatable. So this is a very pared back version, but I don't have the numbers, but certainly we're working right now on getting the revenue impact.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for bringing that.
Thank you.
Problem is you can never buy big enough guns if they fill up, no matter what size you buy.
Only your problem.
And I see a lot of guns in homes where they're stuck in a closet, just sitting around, that are really unsafe. And so this would be very helpful. So thank you for bringing that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2915.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2915 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2915 to the floor with a due pass with prior referral to revenue. Representative Greenway.
Yes, just a comment. I generally oppose tax credits beyond the tax credit budget process. So I'm going to vote yes on this, and if it comes separately, I might or might not vote no on the floor. But seeing to me, among the tax credits I've seen, this is would be an extremely useful one, and I hope it gets into the tax credit budget so that it's a part of a rational solution. That's why I was asking how much it might be to see.
Have revenue to find out.
Yeah, yes. They'll have an estimate.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Martin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that post Barker and Krieger are agreeing on a gun bill with Representative Greenlick. I never thought it would happen. So
we have Mellor.
I can die now.
Why me? Yeah.
We've mellowed with age.
Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2349.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2349 deals with professional fiduciaries. We've talked in this committee about guardianships, and a guardian is a type of fiduciary. Another type is a conservator, and that's a person who makes financial decisions for another. Under Oregon law, you can be a professional fiduciary for three or more protected persons who are not related to you. House Bill 2349 extends the information that a professional fiduciary must disclose to a court in a petition for appointment. They must now disclose things such as, or this bill would require them to disclose such things as investment credentials and licensing, as well as a description of the fee arrangement and the total expected annual compensation to be charged. It further clarifies that a professional fiduciary may be a business entity and is not limited to individuals. We're still waiting for the fiscal statement on this bill, so it is not ready to move at this moment.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Martinez, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just thoroughly enjoy your counsel, because someday I'm just going to go up and come up and say what she said, because she does such a great job of explaining what the bill does. So I definitely appreciate that. This bill is kind of a follow-up to a bill that you legislature passed in 2013, which was House Bill 3129, which started the process of setting up some sideboards on these professional fiduciaries. That bill in 2013 basically put in 125.241A, which is proof that the professional fiduciary or an individual responsible for making decisions for clients or for managing client assets for the professional fiduciary is certified for the guardianship certification or its successor. Guardianship certification or its successor organization as a national certified guardian or a national master guardian.
You have to say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I think I know that after all these years. Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, and Independent Community Banks of Oregon. So what the change is in the law, and with me today is Stuart Allen, President and CEO of Allen Trust, so he will be able to answer all your difficult questions. I've warned him that there are some very smart lawyers on this committee. I didn't say who they were, but I said there were some very smart ones on the committee, so to be prepared. But he's been in this business for a long time. As your counsel mentioned, what we're trying to do is get, for consumers' protection and the public's protection, a little bit of knowledge of what they may be faced in fees by the folks that are holding themselves out to be professional fiduciaries. Also, any revenue sharing agreements, any compensation that investment advisors or brokers may charge or receive working together with these fiduciaries, and then how the compensation is going to be provided. Is it going to be commissions, monthly charges, or any other? I know I've talked to most of the committee in the last few days, and I apologize for those that I didn't. There was a big bill on the floor yesterday, and some folks weren't able to come out. But at any rate, and I would just say that, final for the question, Representative Barton, the Oregon State Bar does have some concerns. Since the bill is not ready today, we will certainly work with them and try to address those concerns. I believe it's primarily in language. I'll let Susan Gravy speak for the bar, but I don't think it's an issue with the bill itself. It's with the language, and like I say, she can answer that question. And with that, I would be happy to turn it over again to Stuart Allen, who is is the president of Allen Trust.
Hello, Chair Barker. My name is Stuart Allen, and I'm here to answer any questions that you have. a little background about myself. I run an independent trust company in Portland, and trust company, we are regulated by the bank folks, so we have ongoing exams, capital, bonding, et cetera. The other group of fiduciaries that take care of trusts and conservatorships are private fiduciaries, and those tend to be individuals, a few small entities, and those are the types of folks that this bill would address. And I hope that at this point they're not required to disclose where their fees are coming from and what they're charging. And this bill requires them to not only disclose whether they are an individual serving as a private fiduciary, conservator, et cetera, and what they're charging. And it also requires them to investigate what the charges are, not only for their fees, but any arrangement and fees being charged by outside entities, brokers, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Gravy, did you want to testify at all? Okay, you work. Okay, thank you.
You're done?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2349 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2371.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2371 comes to us at the request of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill provides that the evidence of a test administered or observation made by a police officer as part of a drug recognition evaluation is admissible in a judicial or administrative proceeding if certain conditions are met. Previously, under State versus Amon and its progeny, Oregon courts have ruled that an entire 12-step DRE protocol must be completed for scientific evidence to be admissible. House Bill 2371 provides that evidence of the test administered are admissible if the officer who administered the test was properly qualified, the test administered or observation made was in a manner prescribed by the Department of State Police, and the results of the test or observation were accurately recorded. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. The bill is ready to move today.
Okay, thank you. Please.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Sergeant Evan Sether with the Oregon State Police. I am the state coordinator for Oregon's Drug Evaluation and Classification Program, otherwise known as the DRE program or Drug Recognition Expert Program. And the Oregon State Police is neutral on this bill. However, my intent is to come in here is to provide, give you some overview of the DRE program and give you some factual data as it pertains to the impact of this bill on our program. Now, in my written testimony, there is a bit of background with respect to the development and the requirements of the DRE program, and a couple items that I want to address within those before I move on. To give you a scope of the current state of the program, we currently have 184 drug recognition experts across the state, and those span approximately 66 state, county, and municipal agencies. The certification process does take approximately 120 hours of training, both in field work and classroom, before they're certified, and they obviously have to adhere to strict standards beyond that in terms of maintaining the certification. As a context in terms of how active this program is, since the beginning of 2011, looking at four calendar years, DREs in Oregon performed over 5,500 drug evaluations on subjects that were in custody for driving under the influence, and that their opinions were confirmed by toxicology in over 89% of those cases. And when we look at within that range of those 5,500 evaluations, we had approximately 250 subjects who were determined to be not impaired at the time of the evaluation and 200 subjects that were deemed to be medically impaired at the time of the evaluation. That roughly constitutes 8 to 9% of our evaluations. Now, moving towards the impact of House Bill 2371, as previously mentioned, the current legal environment, as those other cases of reference, do not permit the DRE protocol to be introduced into court as scientific evidence unless all 12 steps are completed. And there's a couple of times when that would arise. The first is, since this is a voluntary evaluation, at some point the person may refuse to continue that evaluation, at which point we have to stop, and obviously not all 12 steps are completed. There may be an opportunity where the subject refuses or is unable to provide a toxicology sample, so the 12th out of the 12 step is not fulfilled. There may be at some point during that the DRE recognizes that there is an acute or serious medical issue that needs to be addressed immediately and thus terminates the evaluation. And then there may be circumstances where actually due through court proceedings, the urine sample or some step is suppressed, and therefore not all 12 steps are admitted into that process. So in each of those circumstances, an important thing to remember is that the DRE may still actually have sufficient information to form an opinion as to whether or not the person was impaired, and if so, what the source of the impairment was. The difficulty comes in that there's not a consistent standard across the state in terms of how that is applied. In certain circumstances, every step that was completed is allowed to come in. In other jurisdictions or other judges allow only certain steps to come in, but not others. And each time there's this case-by-case different analysis on those different the admissibility of those particular steps. So what this bill does is establish that consistency statewide in terms of what can potentially be admitted in. So in terms of how this affects the program, in terms of, the number of cases where this would directly affect, since January 2011, so looking again at the last four calendar years, Oregon DREs had 334 evaluations that were essentially deemed as incomplete. And so when I mentioned those four instances where it would not be considered a full protocol, some data on that, this is essentially is at, 76% of those cases involve somebody who refused to provide a urine sample. 14% were due to some refusal midway through, some point through the evaluation. And then 10% where toxicology was not available and thus was not that 12th step was, again, missing. That roughly constitutes approximately 6% of the drug evaluations that Oregon DREs performed in the last four calendar years. So this concludes my testimony on it, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have with respect to the program.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. Sir, thank you for coming in, and we didn't get a chance to talk before this. I would have given you the questions before, and I'm a skeptic of this bill. I don't mean to put you on the spot.
But all right.
And if you don't know, that's no problem. But this bill would essentially, right now, we do have an entity that is authorized to make rules and standards to determine the admissibility of partial DRE. That is the courts, through case law, State v. Amon, the project. Now, they happen to have concluded that these are inadmissible at partial DRE test. However, this bill would shift that authority from the courts, where it traditionally rests, to the state police. Is there another example, another line of cases or evidence where the legislature has shifted authority to make a rule of this nature from the courts to the state police?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, that's an interesting question. Directly aligned with this here in this state, I'm personally not aware, and I would defer to Department of Justice. They may have some more information on that one. In my understanding, with respect to these two cases, specifically State v. Sampson, State v. Amon, mm-hmm. Is the introduction of the protocol as scientific evidence. And so in those other cases where it's not a complete protocol, it comes in as more of a layman's evidence type of a thing. It's under the current kind of procedure. But again, it's just that's the consistency by which certain steps are admitted or not is the portion that I'm aware that this is addressed. So.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. Another question. So this bill as written in Section 1 would essentially, this legislature would delegate that authority to the state police, to your agency, but doesn't really have much sideboards in the way of what rules you might choose to promulgate, assuming, of course, it would have to have a rational basis to withstand some scrutiny. But let's pretend it could be a pretty flimsy rule. In fact, that provided you met that certain rational basis, whatever rule you promulgated, and then the officer recorded it accurately. As I read it, it would trump all other evidentiary balancing tests, say the rule of evidence 401, relevance, probative in 402, 403, is it unduly prejudicial? And I'm trying to think have we ever done anything like this before in Oregon law? Yeah, I'm sorry to throw this at you. I would have gotten it to you beforehand.
That's quite all right. Chair Barker, Representative Barton. Recognize is that in terms of establishing those rules would probably fall, it would probably fall under that Oregon administrative rule. And that's actually already addressed in the Oregon administrative rules. I believe it's 257 Division 25 that does talk about which tests can be administered, and then it does give descriptions of those particular exams. So it does address with some respect the standard of and how to perform that test, and then the accurate and then the training, everything comes along that, and then certainly the certification process and everything else, which is actually already outlined in our current DRE policies. So to some extent, it is addressed in terms of field sobriety tests and which ones are allowed and which ones are not. In a broader sense, I couldn't accurately address that question. So
that was a good answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
I'm going to say first, I share Representative Barton's astonishment that we would give the state police the authority to promulgate rules that define what's admissible and what's not admissible. Seems a trifle odd to me, but I'd like to take a different tact. I'm essentially a researcher, and I've done a lot of scale development kind of things, and it seems to me the full test with all its steps has a defined sensitivity and specificity, or the extent to which it produces false negatives or false positives, but I sense there's no evidence as to how various components, and there's an infinite number of components, of 1 through 9, some combination of 1 through 9, so somehow we're shifting this from scientific evidence to lay evidence, and I wonder what the theoretical or the practical basis is for saying, well, we know if you do it all, it has a certain 89% true positive test, although it doesn't say how much true negatives. And the question is, how do we know what some 1, 4, 7, and 9 makes, what the outcome for that kind of combination, or 1, 2, 3, 5, and 8 make? I mean, how can you provide lay evidence that some subgroup of the total scale makes any sense?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, is my understanding and in my experience in terms of these situations where we have partial evaluations, that in my particular case, I came in and testified as to what I observed and what that was consistent with, and the jury was instructed to evaluate that and given the weight of the evidence in comparison to any all the other evidence that was presented as the trier of fact. And in terms of if particular steps, if there's a certain number that add up to give it some additional weight beyond just the content of those, you know, or the results of those particular steps, certainly at some point the drug recognition expert still has to be able to articulate as to whether or not that substance, whether that is enough for them to render form an opinion in their mind as to whether the person's impaired or not, and if so, whether it's a drug or a medical impairment, and if it's a drug impairment, what combination of drugs or whatever is at play. But that is that again in my and again anecdotally in my experience, it has been introduced, and the jury is a trier of fact as to whether they should give that weight with respect to the totality of the circumstances and all the rest of the evidence prevent it. I'm not aware of anything that talks about that gives a certain number that addresses, I guess, the validity of certain number of steps. There is a particular study that does address drug recognition evaluations that was done here in Oregon. It's titled Drug Recognition Expert Evaluations Made Using Limited Data. And in that case, drug recognition experts were actually given reports that had information redacted. So there was no information with respect to the subject's name, how they were encountered, if there was any other evidence. It was purely looking at how the person performed on field sobriety tests during the evaluation and what clinical signs, essentially a limited and incomplete evaluation. And in that particular study, they were overall accuracy in terms of recognizing drug intoxication was at 95%, and their overall accuracy at determining the correct drug category that was at play was at 80%. So in some sense, DREs are still effective at determining the correct drug category at play, even using limited data. But again, that's in a that was a particular study and doesn't necessarily address the concerns of you know, certain rules of evidence or the trier of fact. I can't speak to that, the legal environment. So,
may I follow?
Yes, you may.
Was that 20% that it didn't get it right? Was that a false positive that said the person was impaired but they actually weren't? What was the false
there
positive?
I was going to reference that particular element. There was a there were a total of I'm trying to scan through the correct data here. There was 5 suspects who were presumably not drug impaired, and the officers made a correct positive call on the drug impairment in 65% of that. There was essentially one false positive, but it was difficult. There was such a limited data with respect to that false thing. I don't know if they were able to draw an accurate conclusion with respect to the false positive rate. Again, that's based off my
positive is the problem in this case, right?
Yes, but and my apologies, Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick. That's a we have. I want to address a certain issue that comes up with that, and that is the limits of the current toxicology situation that we have right now. Oregon is a urine state, and predominantly that's what sample we collect, and that's what's tested predominantly by the Oregon Crime Lab or the state police. Where we have difficulty is there are certain certain drugs that are not detected within the urine. There are certain drugs that are detected in the urine for a very long, a long period of time. In the case of cannabis, you know, 30 to 45 days in chronic users. So it has, we have difficulty because urine has value in terms of showing what was in the system and what was metabolized and is now being excreted, but it doesn't necessarily correlate directly to impairment, and that's where the value of the DRE comes in terms of the rest of the protocol in articulating what those signs of impairment are. You know, and as we move in maybe in the future towards other toxicology samples as a primary focus, there may be some better correlation with respect to what the DRE's opinion is and what is confirmed in toxicology. For instance, in the case of blood, what's actually coursing through somebody's veins at the time that the sample is drawn. So I don't know if I've adequately answered those questions, sir.
That's the problem with making a priori rules rather than letting the judge in the context of a case with other evidence decide how to deal with that. I mean, it seems to me the problem you just referred to is exactly the issue that the judge is supposed to deal with in the context of a case.
Chair Barker and Representative Greenlee, I would defer to the Department of Justice with respect to the legal analysis part. I mean, I have my rudimentary police, understandings of it, but and I believe the Department of Justice representative is here to testify on this bill, so that might be a better question for her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So let me just clarify. When we had this bill before, it would allow instead of 12 steps, you could take 10, and then the jury or judge could weigh that. This, if I'm understanding the way this is written, it would say the state by state police rules, you could essentially order a judge that he has to admit that is evidence. Is that
exactly right?
Okay.
Yeah, and Chair Barker, as I read through that bill,
We can check with DOJ.
My primary role as a representative of the state police and as a program manager is to make sure that my DREs are doing the protocol and doing those particular tests correctly. In terms of how that is borne out in administrative rule or the legal environment would be for better experts with respect to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, of the DUIs where a DRE is involved in, what is the percentage of those cases that are presented to prosecution that are eventually filed? Do you know?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that I can certainly find that data. I can essentially looking at how the court dispositions. We do track court dispositions, but some of the obviously there's some untimely delay, and I don't know if at certain points, all I know is whether the person was convicted, whether they entered into a diversion, or whether the case was dismissed. It's not generally eliminated any further than that based off the rolling logs that DREs submit. So I could find you at least that data. But again, I couldn't tell whether a particular case went to trial at some point and then was dismissed or through a suppression hearing or something like that, or whether it was dismissed right out before it was even brought to court.
Obviously, what drug recognition expert is all about is to determine evidence that, in fact, somebody's impaired. And they're also the 12 steps rule out as well in favor of the individual that they might not be under the influence.
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that is correct. Again, as I mentioned, we had 450 cases where somebody was determined to not be impaired by drugs, and there was another several hundred cases where the person actually had a low blood alcohol content, and the DRE came in and said, "No, the only thing that we are seeing is alcohol. We're not seeing any additional drugs." So there was another. I think it bears out to be roughly 650 cases where they were either not impaired, medically impaired, or by alcohol only, and there was no sign of other drug impairment. And that's out of, the 5,500 evaluations in the last four calendar years.
Just one more follow-up question. Okay, so, Sergeant, you mentioned earlier that you have an 89%, I guess the better term to use on that is success rate. Have you ever compared Oregon to the other states across the country that are doing with their DRE programs for that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I'm aware that may have been done, but the previous state coordinator, Sergeant Mike EY, may have some more experience with respect to how that was. And I could certainly gather that data in as a comparison for other states. Certainly the ones that like Colorado and Washington that have very active programs and that are addressing similar kind of legal environments that we are.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Michael Ewy and Brian Sensori, I think.
Just a second, please. I had a question, remember?
I'm sorry.
Sergeant, you gave us a number of how many partial uncompleted tests there were. Do you have that number?
Yes, Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, we had, it should be in my written testimony, but in the last four calendar years, we had 334 cases where the evaluations were deemed to be incomplete, either due because of, for the various reasons, either they refused to provide the urine sample that was terminated due to a medical issue or the toxicology is not available.
Of those 300 and some cases, how many of them resulted in a conviction?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I don't know off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that information to you.
Appreciate that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Sergeant.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you story. Very much.
Michael Ewy and Brian. I didn't know
that the DOJ was coming out.
Go ahead, need your order. Just be sure to identify yourself on the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Michael Ewy. I'm with the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I serve in the capacity of the Vice President. I'm here to support House Bill 2371. Before I give my my testimony, I heard a couple of questions by both Representative Krieger and Representative Greenlink that I would like to address, Mr. Chair.
Please.
First, on the admissibility of a partial evaluation. Currently, right now, and the Department of Justice, they'll reiterate what I'm about ready to say, but currently, right now, State v. Ahman does allow for the evidence to come in on a partial evaluation, and they deem it as non-scientific. So it's not that we're going to set precedents in the courtroom. We're just using what Ahman already allows police officers to do. And that's part of the problem. That's why we have the bill, is because it's inconsistent from one county to the next. The other question by Representative Greenlink talked about, or I'm sorry, by Representative Barton, again, was with respect to where would this be. This is going to be in the Oregon Administrative Rule Division 25. It's 25705012 under other field and sobriety tests. Those are already outlined right now as far as the drug evaluation classification program, field sobriety tests, and the training components, or the 12 steps that drug recognition experts already perform currently right now. We would just have to modify some of the language. Those are the two questions that I had. I apologize, they both came from Representative Barton. For the offense of driving while under the influence of intoxicants, there is not a better tool that we currently have in Oregon other than the drug recognition expert. As the state coordinator has already testified, we are a very small number. Nationally speaking, there are less than 1% of police officers become drug recognition experts. So when you look at the total numbers of Oregon, if we arrest approximately 22,000 DUIs annually, that number is going to increase to with the passing of Measure 91. In addition to that, we perform approximately 1,500 drug evaluations annually, which works out to be approximately 60 a day are arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. 4 to 5 of those are drug impaired. These specially trained men and women are tasked to determine if the individual is impaired on alcohol, drugs, a combination of alcohol or drugs, and also on medical impairment, which the state coordinator previously testified about. We work collaboratively with the toxicologists, with the patrol officers, for a DUI investigation. Right now, and I know that many of the committee members know this, but when DREs go to court and we testify as experts, it's because of State v. Sampson. And Sampson basically identified the 12-step process as a scientific method to determine impairment. We're different in that way. The only other state that I know that uses DREs as quote-unquote scientific would be the state of Washington, and that's Beatty versus Washington. There are other states that look at the totality of the DRE program, and the DRE program is all 50 states, Canada, China, Sweden, and Germany, all deploy drug recognition experts to combat drug-impaired driving. There are other states that look at the process of the protocol, and they say the entire protocol itself is non-scientific. So as many of you know, evidence comes into court as either lay opinion, non-scientific, or scientific. And we, because of State v. Sampson, we have looked at the protocol as a scientific evaluation when you get 12 steps. So I would defer to the committee to look at other cases where you have crimes. You have other specialties like traffic reconstructionists. We're not limiting the information that they're allowed to bring in for the trier of fact to come to a determination. We are asking the same thing with this bill. Whatever the DRE is able to capture during that evaluation, which is based on consent, should come in so it can be evaluated by the jury and or the judge. It is not a bill that's going to automatically say somebody is guilty and prosecute them for DUI as far as a conviction. All we're saying is that that information, whether it be two steps, whether it be 12 steps, the DRE should be able to talk about that for the trier of fact. It's going to go to the weight of the evidence. So whatever comes in, the DRE still is going to have to articulate the impairment, still going to have to present that material clearly and convincingly to a jury for them to make a decision. Also, with the passage of Measure 91, final thought on that, states that I've talked about that look at this as non-scientific are Minnesota, Florida, Nevada, and Utah. They all have case law on the books right now that says it's non-scientific. And when you break down each of the 12-step process, if you look at what the DRE is doing, we're taking temperature. How many of us take temperature on our children? We take blood pressure. We estimate pupil sizes using a pupillometer card. We do field sobriety tests that we teach at the academy to recruits. So when you break down each of these steps, the only thing that we have right now as far as in Oregon that identifies anything as scientific other than the complete evaluation is the horizontal gaze nystagmus test itself. And again, we teach that to recruits at recruit school, and that will be covering State v. Nagel. Also for your consideration is the passage of Measure 91. We're going to expect to see an increase in impaired driving arrests if we can assume that our numbers will be closely related to both Colorado and Washington. As you know, we are a state that utilizes urine in our drug toxicology. And we know that when an individual ingests marijuana, it stays in there for a significant amount of time. And its relationship, when we bring it into court, has nothing to do with the impairment. Nothing at all, because it stays in the system for so much longer. So in order for us to hold folks accountable, what's going to have to be really stressed to our communities and to our officers is the ability for that DRE to come in and testify to the impairment that they see. On the DRE drug evaluation classification form face sheet, there are over 106, there's actually 107 different pieces of information that the DRE is capturing. They base their opinion on the totality of the evaluation, not any specific individual step. It's everything is considered, because that has to get through a jury, and that jury has to understand whether that individual is going to be impaired or not in association with the operation of a vehicle. So with the passage of Measure 91, it's going to be important that we continue to train our DREs and that the DREs are able to testify, just testify, to what they were able to do that night on the evaluation. House Bill 2371 will discontinue the inconsistent courtroom application based upon State v. Ammon, where some counties are allowing it in, other counties are not. There are some requirements with this bill, and the requirement is that the officer is both properly trained and that the officer also records and accurately interprets what the officer observes. I thank you very much for your time, committee members. Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Representative Freeman?
I thought I was hearing what you said, but what this does in Section 3 is it automatically requires those observations to be entered as evidence, regardless of the extent to which the test was done. Is that right? Is that how you read Section 3?
Chair Barker, Representative Green, like how I understand the bill and the spirit behind the bill is for part of the drug evaluation, whatever parts the DRE is able to perform, that is going to be allowed to come into court.
That's going to be admissible as evidence.
It's going to go to the weight of the evidence. All we're saying is that comes in for the court to interpret.
There's evidence of a test administered or observation made by a police officer as part of a drug evaluation is admissible under subsection 2. So this law would require that to be viewed as admissible, regardless of whether the judge thought it was admissible or not. Is that how you read 3?
Chair Barker, I represent Green Lake. That's not how I interpret the bill because of what is actually occurring when we go to the courtroom. Sometimes if you don't have what I'm trying to separate here is you have less than 12 steps, and then the issue becomes, it depends on your jurisdiction, are you going to be able to testify about what you did? And other specialties where law enforcement respond and a specialty services provided, I'm not aware of any other specialty where there's so much inconsistency on can the officer talk about what they did. Not obviously we're bringing it into court so it can be evaluated by the trier of fact, but we just can't bring it in some jurisdictions. So if you have 11 steps or if you have 2 steps, it just doesn't come in. So that's the spirit behind the language, how I interpret it, sir.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brian Cinsoni with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I'm a deputy district attorney with Clackamas County. I've been there for about 5 years now and have prosecuted dozens upon dozens of driving under the influence cases, many drug-impaired driving cases. Just settled a manslaughter in the first degree last week where we had a methamphetamine DUII. We have another one coming up here in a couple weeks. And so this is an issue that that certainly needs to be addressed, and we certainly believe we'll see more of this with the passage of Measure 91. A lot of what's been said already by Officer EY and others, and I know Dino Ryerson is also here from DOJ, I'm going to echo a few of the things that they've said. I think our biggest concern as DAs is not only the inconsistencies that are occurring from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but literally from courtroom to courtroom. On any given Thursday, you could have 2 separate drug-related DUII trials going on in the Clackamas County Courthouse, and if full 12 steps aren't done in both, one judge may let in all the evidence observed by DRE because they feel that it's sound, where another judge may not. So there is an inconsistency not only from county to county, but from courtroom to courtroom. And just, of course, this is anecdotal, but some of my colleagues, we were discussing this morning. I had one colleague who the DRE went through all 12 steps, but one of the 3 measurements for heart rate wasn't completed. And because of that, the whole DRE protocol was called into question. There was over half a day of motions heard, and some of the other observations that were completed accurately, recorded accurately, weren't allowed in as evidence. And so the fact finder was never able to hear that evidence that otherwise would have been sound, but for not taking a proper pulse rate. And I think, Representative Greenlake, that goes to some of the concerns I think I hear you expressing, is that we're going to be requiring judges to let in this evidence. This evidence would otherwise come in but for one small misstep in the process. And it might not be even an issue with the DRE collecting the evidence. It could be an individual unable to provide a urine sample or something else that prevents the full protocol from occurring.
It might not only be one. It might be 5 missteps or 8 missteps or 6 missteps.
Right.
I should say it's admissible however many missteps there were.
Well, and I guess my answer to that would be, again, it would go to the weight of the evidence, and there would be rigorous cross-examination from the defense. If they believe that there were something to be called into question, obviously they're going to be probing the sufficiency of the state's evidence if they believe that there's not enough of the steps completed to make any sort of determination. But, for example, if you had an individual who participated fully in the protocol, but for some reason had a bum ankle and couldn't perform the walk and turn test because of their inability to walk and refused that portion of the test for whatever reason. All the other measurements that had been taken, all the other statements that had been taken may now come into question because that one step was not followed completely. So what this bill is seeking to do is simply provide a level playing field in all courtrooms and all jurisdictions that would say, if this evidence was collected properly, then it should be put in front of the fact finder, expose it to cross-examination, let all of the facts be ventilated, and ultimately let the fact finder make a determination about what the truth of the matter is. And so that's what we're asking the committee to do. And I can certainly answer any other questions you might have.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. District Attorney, for coming in to talk to us. I'm a little confused about the admissibility issue. It's been a while since I've been a litigator, so I'm going to ask you a couple questions on that. Is it the case that under current law, if not all 12 steps of the test have been completed, it's per se inadmissible? Or is it up to a judge to determine based on facts and circumstances if it's admissible?
Chair Barker, Representative Leininger, that's correct. It's the latter. So you would have a situation where a defense attorney would move to suppress the entirety of the protocol or at least the opinion of the evaluator, the expert, and then there would be a determination of each of the 12 steps. And if it has an imprimatur of science to the degree that the court is not willing or uncomfortable with its admissibility, a step that was otherwise properly completed may not come in because that whole protocol wasn't completed.
Oh, may I have a follow-up?
Yes, you sure
can. I think what I just heard you say is that it's not per se inadmissible, but rather the court determines based on its expertise about judging the admissibility of evidence whether to admit it. And it seems to me like this rule really does wholesale substitute the judgment of a different branch of government, essentially, for the judgment of the judiciary in determining something that's, you know, really squarely right in the middle of their core function, the admissibility of evidence. So I guess I'm a little bit concerned about this also.
Sure, and I can certainly, I respect your concern. I think the issue for us would be, as I mentioned, the inconsistency of the application currently, and that you can have some judges that would allow evidence in and others that would not. And in situations where, like I was expressing, that, you know, there's one step that's not completed, or even if it's two or three, all the others are sound. You know, the temperature was taken, and the temperature is high, and the blood pressure is high, and the pulse rate is high, all indicative of somebody, say, under the influence of a central nervous system stimulant. But because we didn't properly perform the walk and turn test, those tests, which are highly probative to what we're trying to determine, whether or not the person's under the influence, are now possibly not going to be coming in, where down the hall, a different judge may be allowing that evidence in. And so we're simply asking that all of the evidence come in if the individual step is performed properly, and if it is, let the fact finder make that determination about what value they should give to it.
Do some judges believe they're not allowed to admit anything if all 12 aren't there? I mean, is there just like a clarification issue there?
Well, speaking just from my own experience, I think that the DRE process for some judges is difficult to understand. And sometimes they will just err on the side of caution and not allow a lot of evidence in as a result. That's just been my experience. Some of our judges are much more comfortable with it, and they'll certainly allow more in. But it's been an uneven application from my vantage point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to follow up on Representative Leininger's question about judicial discretion in bringing in evidence. Say you have a partial DRE and the bill as it stands would require that be admissible. But what if you had a 403 exclusion motion in front of the court on one of those steps of the DRE? Is the court then barred from hearing that motion because the law would then say it is admissible?
Right. Well, I think that would certainly be our argument. I think, you know, a 403 argument from the other side would be that the value of the evidence is so prejudicial that it outweighs its probative effect. And I think that if you have, you know, let's say somebody with, as I mentioned, aspects of or certain their blood pressure's up, their temperature's up, that's probative to what we've alleged,
right?
You know, that they're under the influence. And we would make the argument certainly that the probative value would outweigh the prejudicial effect.
But could the judge find that a step of a DRE was inadmissible under 403 when the statute says it is admissible. Does this language trump the ability to exclude evidence based on another rule?
Yeah, maybe Dina Ryerson would speak a little bit better to that. I'll let her speak to that.
I'll let her bad clean up the
next. Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I wonder, if inconsistency is a problem, what about a measure that would say you can't admit anything except a complete test? That would make it courtroom to courtroom a level playing field.
If we were to not admit any of the steps, one of them isn't completed?
How would deal with the inconsistency problem?
Well, in my opinion, obviously as a prosecutor, that would be unfortunate in that we'd be losing a lot of evidence. Again, that's very probative. And it's simply a situation where sometimes somebody may be cooperative. They might be under the influence of a narcotic analgesic like heroin and be unable to perform and provide a urine sample. And they've given, up to this point, a lot of evidence of being under the influence. I don't think that we should lose all of that evidence simply because they're of an inability to provide that last toxicological sample.
So inconsistency is not the big issue here. The issue is making sure the evidence gets in.
Well, I think that in any judicial proceeding, we should have the evidence presented to our fact finder in a fair manner. We don't believe that this is asking the courts to admit evidence unfairly. This is evidence that was collected voluntarily and that will, again, help the fact finder. It'll be exposed to cross-examination, and ultimately the fact finder can make a determination about what weight it wishes to give to that evidence. But to wholesale remove all of that other collected evidence would certainly seem to me to be inconsistent with our mission of trying to determine what the truth is.
I just wanted to find out the extent to which inconsistency was your problem, or your problem was not getting things in that you wanted to get in.
Well, inconsistency in the sense that different courtrooms are applying the rules differently, and we would like to see the evidence presented so that we can make that final determination.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I have Gail Meyer and Mr. Wingraff come up next.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This is the third time we're hearing this bill. It was heard in 2011 and 2013. It does come to you in a very unusual posture. The structure of the bill would delegate to a state agency rulemaking authority. And then by purview of that rulemaking authority, that agency could make rules, which then the judiciary shall admit as evidence. So basically you're delegating rulemaking authority to an agency. That agency would have the ability to tell the judiciary, you shall admit this evidence. That's the posture of this bill. And Representative Barton, in answer to your question, I can think of none other that came to us in that posture. I'm going to just testify from the 30,000-foot level and give a little background, and then Mr. Weingart is here. He's a practitioner from Portland who can give the in-the-trenches review. But I essentially have two themes. One is that this is an unnecessary intrusion into something that is a classically judicial function and of which they have a greater expertise than does the legislative body. And my second theme is that this is premature. This issue of admissibility of DRE component testimony is an interlay of a lot of confusing evidentiary rules. You've got relevancy and 403, which is basically the court's inherent authority to determine whether or not something is more prejudicial than probative or takes more delay or too confusing for the jury, interlaced with what is scientific testimony, what is non-scientific testimony, interlaced with who can give an expert opinion, who can give a scientific expert opinion, who can give a non-scientific expert opinion, and who can give a layperson's opinion. All of these rules are garbled together in this issue when you have an incomplete DRE. The courts are on it. They've been handing down very cogent opinions, all of which are pretty consistent with each other. It's not an instance when the Court of Appeals has issued court decisions that are conflicting and it's chaotic. The courts agree. What they've said is you need all 12 of the DRE protocols to come in as scientific evidence. If it's less than scientific evidence, it may or may not be admissible. But this is what Judge Brewer wrote. So when Judge Brewer was, he's now on the Supreme Court, he's now Justice Brewer, but at a time when he was with the Court of Appeals, he authored the decision in State versus Rambo. And in Rambo, the trial court judge had partially admitted some incomplete DRE protocols, but had excluded others. And the Court of Appeals said the trial judge got it right. So this is what Judge Brewer said. As we've explained before, the admissibility of the complete DRE protocol as scientific evidence does not demonstrate the general admissibility of each component of the protocol. We've concluded in Amman that an incompletely administered DRE protocol is not admissible as scientific evidence, although we noted that evidence of individual components of the DRE protocol were not necessarily inadmissible as non-scientific evidence. So the standard that's been established by the Court of Appeals is incomplete protocols are not necessarily inadmissible. Admittedly, that's a double negative. But what the bill says is they all are. And for those who are familiar with the admissibility of evidence, that's a huge gap because the judge is in the middle who's deciding this is in, this is out, and for these reasons. And so the bill really does flip the holding of the Court of Appeals decisions, which all agree with one another. So in 2011, when this statute first came down the pike, what I'm holding here are the 8 amendments that were attempted to be drafted by the lawyers on the House Judiciary Committee. And by then I'm talking about Chris Garrett, Matt Wan, and Wally Hicks. They put their hands on this, and they strived hard, and they came up with 8 different versions, and they were just like, it doesn't work. I mean, they were saying, well, it's except as otherwise provided by the Constitution or the Oregon Constitution, the statutes of this state. It may be admissible. I mean, they kept trying, and it didn't work. It just didn't work. So that was the effort in 2011. I don't remember a similar effort in 2013, but this is the third time that this committee has had this decision. So we do submit that this is an unnecessary override or an intrusion into what's an inherently and classically a judicial function. The Court of Appeals are doing it right. If there is some confusion in the trial courts, that's because these are a lot of evidentiary rules all colliding with one another. But all they have to do is come into the courtroom with the case law, all of which is pretty consistent, and argue it. And the state does have its remedy. Its remedy is to go up on appeal. Again, what they're asking this body to do is delegate to a state agency the authority to make rules, and then by purview of those rules, the evidence shall come in. And that's a remedy that I don't remember being entertained in any other bill. So last comment, it is premature to say that it's one thing to delegate to the Oregon State Police the rulemaking authority of what shall constitute a complete DRE. I don't think we really have opposition to that. But it would be difficult for me to surmise that the committee would be comfortable agreeing that anything they should report in those rules would necessarily be admissible when you don't even yet know what's in the rules. So I'm done with my comments. I don't know if you want. Yeah.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Weingart. I'm a Portland criminal defense attorney. I practice in Portland as well as other areas of the state, and a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Today, you're being asked to fix a problem that, in my opinion, doesn't exist. In the fix for the non-existent problem, you're being asked to make admissible in court testimony, which in case after case has been held to sound scientific, despite not being scientific, and I believe you should be skeptical of this. Three times in the last 3 years, the Court of Appeals has visited cases of incomplete drug recognition evaluations. Those cases are State versus Rambo. The site there is 250 ORAP 186. That's 2012. State versus Beck. That's 254 ORAP 60. That's also 2012. And State versus Wilson, 266 ORAP 286. That's from October in 2014. In all three of those cases, the Court of Appeals sided with the trial court judges when those judges admitted evidence regarding the consumption of drugs, meaning at the trial court level, someone said, well, it's an incomplete DRE. You shouldn't admit this evidence. And the judges said, no, no, no. We are going to admit evidence of the consumption of drugs and evidence of the impairment, despite the fact that those officers didn't and weren't able to conduct full DRE examinations. In only one case, which is a very very well-written opinion, State versus Rambo, did the court exclude evidence, and there the trial court excluded some evidence, allowed other evidence, and the Court of Appeals agreed with everything that the trial court did. So you've heard today that there are no consistent standards as to what judges are allowed to do, but the empirical facts show that three cases have gone up on appeal, and in all three cases, the Court of Appeals has agreed with what the trial court judges have done, meaning those judges have gotten this right. aside from that, you've heard that basically these things are happening differently in different counties. In those three cases, Rambo was from Multnomah County, Wilson was from Josephine County, and Beck was from Marion County. So I can't sit here and talk to you about what I don't know about what's happening in courtrooms. This is what's happened in the Court of Appeals when these issues have gone up, is the Court of Appeals has agreed with the trial court judges. In that one case where the court excluded evidence, the evidence that was excluded was excluded on the basis that it sounded scientific, but both the trial court and the Court of Appeals found that that evidence was not actually scientific. The excluded portions were things that Mr. Censoni discussed with you: pulse rate, temperature, the darkroom test, the muscle examination, and basically all of those portions have a sound that they smack of science, but in certain other cases, the courts have found that each one of those portions in and of itself is not a piece of scientific evidence that's been proven to scientifically show impairment. It's only when the group of evidence is combined into the 12-step DRE process that it is scientifically valid, and that is the fact that the scientific evidence is admissible as a whole, but not each one of its individual parts. And that was the holding in Rambo, and Rambo makes very clear this is a 12-step test. The steps are outlined. They're outlined in the OARs. They're outlined in the officers' materials where they're trained to do these steps. And Rambo goes through and says which of these portions of the test are scientific, which of these portions of the test are not, and thus which of these portions of the test, when it is not a complete scientific evaluation, should be admissible and which not. So the fact is, there's a roadmap for what trial court judges are supposed to do in this situation. And it seems out of the Court of Appeals that they're doing that. As opposed to what a trial court judge can get into and what they might learn from their experience with these issues, a jury doesn't understand the lack of science backing up certain evidence. When an officer says in an incomplete drug recognition examination, because of things like pulse rate, temperature, the results of my darkroom examination, the results of the examination of the defendant's muscles, it's my opinion that the defendant was under the influence of, and then insert insert the controlled substance that they're trying to prove in the case. That sounds like it's backed up by science, even when previous courts who have visited this issue agree that certain portions are not individually admissible because they are not backed up by science as an individual piece. The courts are gatekeepers of scientific evidence. In Oregon, scientific evidence is evidence that draws its convincing force from some principle of science, mathematics, and the like. And in State versus O'Keefe, the court actually extends our definition of scientific evidence in Oregon, not just to evidence that is scientific, but evidence that sounds scientific should be considered scientific evidence. Professor Kirkpatrick, who writes basically the primer on evidence in the state of Oregon, says, evidence that is likely to influence and hence possibly mislead jurors as conveying, and I want to thank Mr. Censoni for making me not the first person to use the phrase imprimatur of science, and so I'm the second person who has to say that today. My apologies for having to use it. Evidence that is likely to influence and hence possibly mislead jurors as conveying the imprimatur of science must satisfy the Brown and O'Keefe requirements. Each time this issue has been decided by the Court of Appeals, they have agreed with the trial court that the trial court got it right. Judges have found that these things are not scientific. In my opinion, the individual pieces presented individually and not as a whole has the capacity of misleading jurors, and I believe the legislature should exercise caution when legislating in this realm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. I'd like to call Dina Ryerson, please.
Good afternoon. Sorry, my voice sounds really raspy. My name is Dina Ryerson with the Oregon Department of Justice. I've testified in front of this committee years in the past, but just briefly, my background is I've been working at Department of Justice for almost 9 years, exclusively in the area of DUI. So I'm intimately familiar with the DUI case law in this state. I work with prosecutors, I work with law enforcement, all in the area of DUI, and I train prosecutors and law enforcement. I feel like some things need to be clarified and cleaned up, and I realize it's getting late in the day, so I'm going to try and make this quick. This bill does not overrule or change any case law in the state of Oregon. The cases that Mr. Weingart were referring to did not set a ruling as to what evidence in an incomplete evaluation come in. They did not set it, nor did they agree with the trial court to say, yes, this is going to be our rule that is now going to be spread out across the state of Oregon. The result of that, and when we're talking about inconsistencies, it's not within the Court of Appeals. It's within the trial court level on a day-to-day basis around the state. And this is what I hear from prosecutors every day around the state. And so what we're hearing is the same exact set of facts. You have 11-step protocol. You have 11 steps that a person has consensually given, has given consent to provide this evidence, to go through these steps, and this evidence is collected consensually, just like all other types of evidence that, you know, that a person will go through. They ask their cooperation, and the person gives it. So this evidence is collected consensually. At that point, there may be situations like the person will tamper with the urine sample. That happens routinely. Well, not routinely, but it happens numerous times where someone will dip their urine sample in the toilet water, and then they will not be able to use the sample. And the result of the defendant's actions to either refuse to provide urine or to tamper with the urine sample, the result of that is that it leaves the remainder of the evidence in limbo as to whether that evidence can come in. The case law is very clear. It is very consistent to say that it is only scientific protocol when all the 12 steps are entered into evidence. When it is less than 12 steps, it comes in It's not clear what comes in, but what the case law does say, as several people prior to me said, was it's not necessarily inadmissible, meaning it's admissible as non-scientific evidence, but there's no clarity on what is admissible as non-scientific evidence. So the result is you have courtrooms across this state with the same exact type of set of facts, same thing. You'll have all 11 steps, one step's gone. And the court rulings will be different around the state. And that's not what we would hope to see for going to the trier of fact, to be able to be given the evidence that the person consensually gives and to be able to make their opinion. The other thing that wasn't mentioned by Mr. Weingard and Ms. Meyer is the fact that this evidence is used by the prosecution, but it is also used by the defense. This is evidence that when it comes in, can cut both ways. It can hurt the state when they say, well, look, this evidence that came forward is more consistent with non-impairment, or this is consistent with impairment. And it's used equally across the board, either for the defense to help their case or for the prosecution. And that's really the whole point behind this, is that the jury gets to then decide, with the evidence in front of them, what they're going to make a decision on impairment. I believe there's been some questions about, have we as a legislature ever done this before? And the answer is yes. A few years back, there was a court ruling that said urine needed a scientific foundation laid every time urine was going to come into evidence. And the legislature immediately acted and said, no, we are going to make it in law that urine comes into evidence, period, without having to lay a scientific foundation. And that was one area where the legislature said, no, we're not going to have inconsistency across the board. And that's one area, and you all asked for an example, that's one example I can give to you. the other thing that was brought up was the 12 steps and how this is premature because there's nothing that outlines what those 12 steps are and it gives OSP this authority. That actually isn't the case. State versus Sampson does list exactly what those 12 steps are. And the case law subsequent to them, some of which Mr. Weingart pointed out, also refers to what those 12 steps are. So this is not something that the Oregon State Police can just decide, oh, we're going to make up all these other steps. The case law is specific as to what those 12 steps are, and that's what's designated as considered a 12-step protocol in State versus Sampson. The other thing is that it is outlined in the Oregon Administrative Rules. And so this isn't something where authority is being given to the Oregon State Police that somehow allows them to create these steps that have not been previously discussed. In addition, these steps are the steps used internationally by the International Association of Chiefs of Police that have set the protocol, the 12-step protocol, founded, over years and years of developing the program. So this is not, again, something that Oregon State Police is going to just decide, as it's in case law and it's in the Oregon Administrative Rules. As far as previous attempts to pass this legislation, there is a reason why this is being brought forward, is because it will assist the trier of fact, whether good or bad, whether good for the prosecution or good for the defense, it will assist the trier of fact in having all the evidence. One example of this, and we've talked about previous people who've testified have talked about Measure 91 and the fact that assuming we fall in line with Colorado and Washington, see an increase in marijuana DUIs. The number one defense expert that the defense uses, about 95% of the cases where there is a defense expert being called in a drug DUI case, used to work for the Oregon State Police. And he did a study back in, I believe it was 1999, where he looked, and this is an example of what we're talking about, the accuracy of our drug recognition experts in the state of Oregon. They looked at 66 samples where the report said that they were looking for THC, the active ingredient of marijuana, to come back in the urine. So he was looking for the report said negative. There was no controlled substance found, and that was based on the cutoff levels that the crime lab was using. And he said, okay, well, I want to actually, and this is where the DRE called impairment. And he said, I really want to look at this. So he looked at 66 samples where they said that there were no controlled substances. He looked at the cutoff level and said, let's lower the cutoff level and let's look to see if THC was found in the urine. In all samples, all 66 samples in the lower cutoff levels, THC was found in the, or I'm sorry, the not THC, it's the metabolite of THC, excuse me, was found in the urine. So in all 66 where they said the DRE didn't get it right, they actually did get it right. And so that's an example from the defense, the expert that's used in 95% of the cases. And in his final conclusion, he says it can be concluded that a DRE prediction of the presence of cannabis is extremely accurate, and the limiting factor is the detection limits prescribed by the DUI statutes. And that was different at the time. But it says prediction by DREs of specific categories is highly accurate. Again, I just want to emphasize that this is a tool that that prosecution can use, which is the evidence can be presented to the trier of fact. This is also a tool for the defense to use to have all the evidence put in front of them so that they can convince the jury that they're not impaired. And it cuts both ways. And finally, this is all consensually given evidence. This is all something that a person gives by their free will. And as the Oregon State Police individuals have noted, that when someone says stop, I don't want to do anymore, they stop. And so it's the evidence that is provided is consensual, and both sides get to attack it for whatever value it's worth. And I'm here to answer any questions.
This is the same question I asked before about 403 with the language in this bill and your urine example. Does urine get in if you've got another evidentiary motion to try to keep it out?
Yes, urine gets in. Urine is admissible, and that was based on the legislative action.
Okay. So in your reading of this bill, would that be the same way, that this evidence would get in no matter what other motion you had to keep it out?
Sorry, Representative Barker, Representative Williamson. No. And the answer is no, because there are a few exceptions in, and I believe Representative Greenlick picked this out, is as long as the test is administered or observations are made are part of the drug recognition evaluation and that they are done so, you know, properly.
Right.
So there is that gatekeeping function that the court still maintains to say, look, did you do it the way you were supposed to? Because if they didn't, then clearly it's going to be inadmissible. And that's, you know, urine's a little different because either it's collected or it's not. So
no, and I get that. And I would presume that if they met all of the requirements of the statute under the bill, that then you lose your ability to challenge that evidence under any other rule.
Well, and Representative Barker, or Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I think a different way to look at it isn't that they lose their ability to challenge it. What they do is they get to argue why it goes towards impairment or why it doesn't. This is, and Ms. Meyer kept articulating this as very complicated. It's really not complicated. It's either the fact that these pieces of evidence come in as scientific or they come in as non-scientific expert evidence. And that's what all the case law talks about. It's either non-scientific or and so what either the defense or the prosecution can do is then argue, look, the pulse rate was in the normal range. That's an example. And then they can say, that is a sign that the person wasn't impaired. And then the prosecution can say, well, that's one piece of the puzzle that the person was looking at. And so it is admissible, but all sides can argue why that piece of evidence should be considered or...
Right. I was just trying to understand whether or not the judge loses the ability to use the rules of evidence on that, on evidence that's collected under a partial DRE.
And I guess Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, by passing this legislation, it would say that the evidence is admissible as long as collected in right. the appropriate manner. So yes, so that the court will not be able to say we're going to I can't really think of any other basis they would throw it out because it's collected correctly. And it's relevant, it's always relevant to impairment. And so there's no court ruling that I know of that would ever say that this isn't relevant, if that makes sense.
Further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So
not to belabor the point that Representative Williamson just asked, but so we are all in agreement, I believe, that if this bill were passed and the evidence met A, B, and C of Section 2, that the judge, a court, would not have discretion under 403, would not have discretion about whether or not the evidence is admissible under 403, correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, right. That is correct as long as the steps are collected right. Appropriately.
Gotcha. So yes. 403 goes out the window under this bill. May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, we have two more bills to do.
Thank you. So the rules of evidence, of course, are statutory. That's why this is a statute. That's why we address it. However, just as like there are muscles on top of bone, the basis of them is constitutional, or at least many of them. There is, for example, the Confrontation Clause underneath hearsay, for example. That's why we have hearsay rules, because there's some constitutional rights underneath it. And I'm not suggesting that this would be facially unconstitutional. However, as applied, for example, perhaps there are times when 403 courts might have, under certain situations, inherent authority under the state constitutional framework we have to guide evidence, for example. Do you think that there could be potentially as-applied constitutional challenges to this bill? For example, what if there are some hearsay issues with this?
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, Representative Barton, there is no, there's nothing unconstitutional about this bill allowing this consensual evidence in. Clearly, so actually, to answer both of your questions, let's say, for example, I should have thought about this before. Let's say, for example, that the person was invoked and said, "I want to talk to my attorney," but they continued on and asked them consensually to do the protocol, for example. Then there's parts of the protocol that would be suppressed, and so maybe if to make it clearer, although I don't think this bill would change anything like that, those parts would be suppressed if, for example, one of the steps is to find out the person's history and ask them questions, which would have them, of course, speak. Mm-hmm. That would be suppressed. And this would not supersede that constitutional analysis. So I actually thank you. That was a very good point to bring up. There are parts of the Constitution that still could be raised to say, look, you violated my, you know, I invoked. You shouldn't have asked me to say anything else. That would be suppressed on a constitutional basis. This does not change that.
Further? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2371. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2628.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2628 comes to us at the request of Representative Leininger and Senator Gelser. The bill disallows all filing fees, service fees, and hearing fees in an action for a court's stalking protective order, even if additional relief is sought. The bill provides that the court may include protections for a petitioner's children and animals in a stalking protective order. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm Ann Leininger from Lake Oswego, representing Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland, House District 38, and I'm pleased to speak on behalf of House Bill 2628, which would do two things. One, it would empower a court to provide a stalking protective order and associated relief without the burden of a filing fee, and two, it would enable a court to tailor any associated relief necessary to protect the safety and welfare of the victim, children, pets, or service animals. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague, Sybil Hebb, from the Oregon Law Center in just a second, but I think there are two really important things to know about this bill. One, by enacting this legislation, we would be able to protect our ability to qualify. Oregon jurisdictions would protect our ability to qualify for grants under the Federal Violence Against Women Act, which requires that we have this kind of provision in our law. So it's necessary to safeguard our ability to go after grant money. And two, it would, if we enact these rules, it will align our stalking protective order bill with three other important and somewhat related bills. The Family Abuse Protection Act has similar provisions. The Sexual Abuse Protection Order standards are similar, and the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Protection Act also have these provisions. So it's important. It'll help us get grants, and it will help us treat stalking victims similarly, and I hope that means I have Representative Gleeson's support.
I want that ringtone.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Rolling on down the track.
Big moving down the
track. Okay. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you very much to our sponsors and to the committee for the attention to this bill today. As you know, issues of domestic violence and sexual assault are of great importance to us and to our clients, and the dynamic of being trapped in a situation in which a victim and children are unsafe is a huge barrier to escaping poverty. And it's a public health and a public safety issue in our state. And so we're committed to efforts to try to provide resources for victims to overcome those barriers. I'll just echo briefly the comments of Representative Leininger and draw the committee's attention to testimony that's online from Judge Maureen McKnight from the Multnomah County Circuit Court, who has had interactions with the federal grantors and their grant officers, who have indicated to us that we are at risk of being ineligible for the receipt of significant numbers of grant dollars from the Violence Against Women Office. And those grant dollars have been of great benefit to many of our communities, urban and rural, across the state. They fund projects within law enforcement offices, within prosecution offices, at the courts, and also with victim services agencies. And so that's hugely important. We've technically been out of violation for some time and didn't recognize it, honestly. So we need to get that taken care of. And we have spoken with the Judicial Department, and I believe there is information about the fiscal, and there are very few of these filings that have fees attached to them. Most stalking orders under our statute are available without a fee. There are just a few kinds. If you attach requests for economic damages, the court now, our current law, allows the charging or requires the charging of a fee. So that's the piece we need to get rid of. There are only about four cases per year that are filed with that form of relief, so it's a negligible impact on the court system, but a significant impact on our communities. So that's the first part of the bill. The second part of the bill, as the good representative indicated, does provide a provision into the stalking statute that is similar to provisions that exist in the three other protection order statutes that are currently in place that the representative mentioned, and that would allow the court discretion, when the facts warrant, to fashion an order, to tailor the terms of an order so as to meet the specific individual safety needs of the victim and children, as well as service animals or pets. And the reason that's important is when a victim is in danger and there's escalation and safety risk, we need to have the court systems and the protection order systems available in an efficient and effective manner that can be flexible enough to really meet the need that is before them. And so one example of a way in which the current stalking statute is not as flexible as we would like is it Chapter 163, and the direct site is 730, sub 3, it lists the specific types of contact that can be prohibited under a stalking protection order. And that is very protective. That works very well. But it is a one-size-fits-all order, and that's not always the best match for the needs of the victim. And so an example of a circumstance in which the current statute would not allow the court flexibility that does present itself as a need is currently the law can prohibit, for example, waiting outside the home, property, place of work, or school of the victim or the victim's children. Well, that's very useful, but often you may have a place of war where the victim is taking the children to athletic events at a community center or a public athletic field, or maybe the victim is in treatment or needs to go for care at a particular hospital or a particular treatment center. So if there are these locations that have in the past been places where the perpetrator has perpetrated stalking or there has been a safety threat, it makes sense that you would want to to include those places in the order. There's not currently the flexibility to do that. So there are other examples, and specifically one has come up related to pets. The language specifically indicates that protection around pets as well as service animals is allowed as when necessary as a means of protecting the victim and the children. We all know that coercion of animals is a common tactic of abuse within these relationships. When that happens, it can have a significant impact on the victim's capacity to take steps to leave, on the victim's, the children's psychological and emotional health, for example. And that's true of pets. Service animals, of course, are critical to a person with disabilities' capacity to go about their day and to go through the steps of their lives. And so it's very important to include that protection. I want to specifically address a question which I understand has been raised for the committee related to whether or not this form of relief could ever be used or could be used in any circumstance to fashion an order related to possession of a firearm. And I want to just make sure to bring that up and to address it. The answer, I believe, is yes, in narrow circumstances. So this whole the whole purpose of adding this provision into the stalking statute was to allow the judge to think about, to hear the facts, and when the facts warrant, when there is a clear need and there's a nexus between the facts of the case and the relief that the judge feels is appropriate, that's what the purpose of this law is, and there are circumstances in which guns could come into that analysis. Again, I would point out for the committee in considering this that there is, of course, a right to a hearing. There are hearings that are automatically scheduled in these cases, and there is the opportunity for the respondent in the case to appear and show cause as to what the why that order shouldn't enter and what the alternative should be. And so there are due process protections. The respondent has the ability to seek a termination of the order at any time when the facts warrant. We think it's fair, we think it's appropriate, and I would draw the committee's attention to the fact that stalking is really an indicator of lethality in these cases, where there is repeated and unwanted contact causing apprehension for physical safety. We know that that's an indicator that is asked about on lethality assessments that have been published by the Hopkins School of Nursing and other well-recognized national experts. So it's behavior that can have really high indicators of danger. So where weapons are around and there is a nexus and the judge has made a finding based on the individual facts, we think it's appropriate that that be allowed. I would just close in saying that we really appreciate the committee's attention to this issue and the importance of protection orders and the roles that they play in helping victims and their children get on and move towards safety and stability. And I would circle back to just draw to summarize that when this initial legislation was passed back in the late 80s, I believe, it was with the sponsorship of then-legislator Kevin Mannix. And that was in response to the case of a woman named Rebecca Schaefer, who was a Lincoln High School student, grew up in Portland, moved to make her way in her career quite successfully in Hollywood as an actress. And she was stalked over a period of years and was shot to death by her stalker in 1989. And so that prompted many efforts across many states to provide this form of relief. And so we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Do we not have another bill coming that brings Oregon into line with a federal statute which would deal with the guns in that case?
That's okay. Correct, Chair Barker and members of the committee. That's correct. That's a Senate bill.
Thank you. Because yeah. There is a lot of concern. I've got a lot of emails about this bill and the concern of the lack of due process for somebody to mm-hmm. have their weapons seized. So we'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
I should ask any questions for anybody else.
Thank you. That was my question.
Thank you. You know what, Mr. Stern, do you want to come up there for briefly? If you just briefly tell us your concerns. We have one more bill we're trying to get in today. We're going to get.
Yeah, very briefly, Kevin Sarrett, Oregon Firearms Federation, and that is the exact concern we had with this bill, and a very different take on it. This does add the language that appears in other protective and stalking orders, restraining orders, and it does give the judges pretty much unlimited ability to restrict firearms rights. And the problem is that it's often misused, and the people who have this right taken away, we don't take any other rights away. We don't take away their right to vote or their freedom of speech except to that other person. These are often misused, and they're often arbitrarily assigned against people who have neither been convicted of a crime nor actually formally accused of a crime. And I can tell you from my personal experience that this is not just applied against, you know, us wife beaters. I was contacted by a 63-year-old woman who lives in Bend alone, who had a dispute with another woman over her perception that this other woman was mistreating horses. This other woman got a restraining order against her. Her firearms were immediately seized and her concealed handgun license was taken away from her. As a result of that, she did something I wouldn't have recommended under other circumstances. She challenged it. So, yes, she got her day in court, and the other side didn't show up, so everything was dropped. But it took her months to get her firearms returned. It took her months to get her CHL returned because she was misinformed by the county. And she is still currently on the list of people who are denied new firearms purchases, although she shouldn't be. And that's the problem, is that there really is no due process for these people. There's not even an opportunity to comply. There's not even an opportunity to just say, yes, I'm going to comply completely. And as for the opportunity to have a hearing, yeah, well, that's true. But here's the problem with having the hearing. If you contest one of these things, now you've had your day in court, and now federal law takes over. And if these orders are upheld, you automatically lose your firearms rights. And what happens in many cases is somebody wants to clear their name, so they go to court to contest it. And the judge says, well, do you plan on stalking this person? Do you plan on calling this person, harassing them? No, absolutely not. Well, then you will have no trouble complying with this order. And now, under federal law, they've completely lost their rights to have firearms in spite of no due process indicating that they committed a crime. And so, if somebody's genuinely dangerous and somebody has actually committed an assault or something like that, there are clearly other legal remedies. But what concerns me is just this blanket ability of a judge to deny somebody their rights in the absence of that kind of due process. And I think obviously the rest of the bill for the four cases that you hear it involves is fine. But I just, you know, I hear from these people regularly who suddenly, yeah, in this case obviously is a very concerning one. A woman living alone in a rural place has her rights taken away for an accusation which had no validity. And so I think that you really need to look very carefully at a judge's ability to make these kind of arbitrary decisions, because it is one of our rights, and it is very concerning that it can be taken away even if a person makes no effort to fail to comply with the order.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2628 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2806.
Oh, I think there was one more person who
I'm
was
sorry, I'm sorry.
Speak.
Was there somebody else to testify on that? No, okay.
She's a domestic violence.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, come on up. I'm sorry. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2628.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the executive director for the Center for Hope and Safety, providing services to victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking in Marion County. Last year, last fiscal year, we had more than 20,000 contacts to our program. Many of those contacts were from individuals who were being stalked in our community and around the state. And our program has actually helped individuals who have ultimately been murdered in the process of being stalked in our community. And I'm here to ask for your support of House Bill 2628 to make those two changes that were explained and make them consistent with other protection orders. What I hope that you understand is that when a victim is stalked, whether it's by a stranger, a former partner, a neighbor, or an acquaintance, it can be absolutely terrifying. The psychological trauma inflicted on stalking victims has lasting implications for the victims and for their children. Stalking is a pervasive problem and a sign of the lethality that Sybil talked about, and these cases are incredibly dangerous. When a victim takes a dangerous step forward to seek help, we must ensure that adequate relief is available. It is important that fast, efficient, and individually crafted relief be available for cases in domestic violence, stalking, and assault. This is available for all other types of protection orders except the stalking order. And individualized relief is really important because of situations. They talked about pets. I can tell you about a situation where I was sitting in a batterer intervention class. A man was talking about how he and his partner had little wiener dogs that they, you know, those were their children to them. And he would kidnap those pets in order to have her do what he wanted. And he used them as a tool. And many of the reliefs that we're talking about in this are actually to do away with those tactics that are being used by that stalker. And so I just encourage you to please consider this bill. Consider the impact that this will have on individuals in your community that are being stalked. It's an incredibly scary thing that's happening to them, and they need your protection. So thank you very much for your consideration.
We expect to get it moved out quickly, but not today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing. House Bill 2628. Open a public hearing on 2806.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2806 comes to us from the American Foundation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. The bill provides the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training may not deny, suspend, or revoke the certification of a corrections officer because the corrections officer seeks help with mental health issues, substance abuse issues, or other counseling needs. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage. We have proposed -1 amendments before us today that provide that the treatment exemption only applies to the first request for treatment by the corrections officer. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you. Mary Bachkid, Jack Dempsey, and Mr. Schroeder. Thank you. We're late in the day, so if you just would introduce yourself by name for the record.
And I'll be quick.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Botkin here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And this bill is introduced at our request. The Reader's Digest version is corrections officers have a high level of stress. They have higher than normal levels of PTSD because of some of the stresses of their workplace and the job that they do. They sometimes find themselves participating in destructive behavior. They fear having their certifications revoked if they go in for any kind of treatment programs. And this bill will quite simply remove the barrier that we face at times in getting officers timely and quick treatment program into treatment programs. I'm going very fast, so let me take a breath. This bill simply gives them an option that says, if you need treatment, if you have a drug or alcohol problem and you go into treatment, you cannot be revoked. You cannot lose, you know, they cannot revoke your certification. You will not lose your job if you go in for treatment or counseling in a timely manner. It assists us in making sure that the workforce remains healthy and does the things that they need to do to cope with the environment in which they work without fear of losing their jobs.
And just thank you. I just would ask, so, but if there's a crime committed involved in that where they would be decertified anyway, this would not change that?
It is not our intent. You know, somebody says, well, what if they murder somebody? Well, they're going to be in jail.
Yeah.
They're not going to be in jail.
You know, so getting revoked seems to be the least of their problems at that point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Schroeder, and I support the passage of House Bill 2806. I am a corporal at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I have worked for the Department of Corrections for almost 10 years. It'll be this September. I am currently a field training officer, which means I train every single new staff that comes in. I am responsible for their training for the first year. I'm also a member of the penitentiary's emergency staff services. What that is a peer-to-peer support. That is my position. It is a voluntary position, but it does give me confidentiality if someone has issues. As was stated earlier, just the stress level in corrections and in other criminal justice law enforcement, parole, probation is higher. We just operate at a higher level of stress, and that builds over time. Unfortunately, we also deal with humans in the corrections environment, and those can create crises, riots, self-harm of inmates, self-harm or assaulting on staff can build up over time, including our personal life. We have people going through divorce, domestic violence, substance abuse, and unfortunately suicides. Over the past 5 years, the department-wide has had a little over 9 suicides, and unfortunately, about 5 of them were my agency, or my institution. Some of these people are very close to me. One of the barriers of a corrections officer is we are not supposed to be weak. We cannot show emotion in front of the inmates. That could be dangerous, and it also shows that we're there to support them so they feel comfortable that we are there as security. A lot of times there's a stigma that if you're asking for help, you could be perceived as weak, when that's not the case. We're just human. And that is my role as a ESS member, is to try to tell people, hey, I'm here for you. If you need to talk to me, you can. But sometimes I am not the most qualified person. There is mental health professionals. That is one big fear, is that if they tell a medical professional, I don't think I can handle the job right now, that they will lose their job or their certification, when that is way far from the truth. They are just seeking help. And that is the mental health professional's responsibility to help them get to where they need to go. Fortunately, I've seen firsthand the effectiveness qualified professionals do have on staff members, and we have salvaged a lot of careers by getting these people to the help they need. And so this bill would break down, I believe, a huge barrier, put it in language. If you seek help before, unfortunately, an incident, if they committed a crime, maybe they could get help before that. Maybe they could get substance abuse help. I think I'm drinking too much before they get that DUI, or they hurt someone because of their actions. And that's what I hope the passage of this House bill will do. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Jack Dempsey representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I have nothing more to add to his testimony there, which was fabulous. I will just reference online additional testimony from Sergeant Jeffrey Hernandez, who was unable to make it today, that has compelling testimony. But just wanted to put our support on the record.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you for your job over there.
Oh, thank you.
I realize that's a tough job. I'm sorry, Representative Krieger.
I can think of a couple things that I went through during the time with the state police. If it would have been just one, when I get divorced, my sister dies, my coach drowns in the Rogue River in 6 months. So if I'd have said anything, which I didn't, I could have been gone from the state police real easy. But what if something else would have happened sometime later? 5-10 year space, another catastrophic event. I don't think I agree with the dash ones. I think there needs to be an evaluation of the individual circumstance at the time, and not some automatic thing because it's one or two or three.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative.
I agree with Representative Krieger. I definitely support this bill. This is a great idea to help people at a time when they need help so they can keep doing a great job with their job. And I was a little worried about the dash one amendments because it artificially caps, circumstances that are beyond our control. Yeah. So I would support it without the dash one amendments.
Okay, thank you.
I want to make that same point. I wondered what their opinion on the dash ones. These are recurring events, and you need to have more options than one.
Mr. Chair, a member of the committee had requested that, and I circled back with our folks at AFSCME, and we respected the member of the committee who wanted that amendment enough that we were willing to agree to that, because we felt like his support was important.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay, thank you. We'll get Ms. Brockham, Mr. Gablet, and Ms. Hale.
Chair,
yes.
And to the witnesses, I really am sorry, especially as I took up so much time with my questions. I have to run early. No disrespect intended. I'll catch up on all this later.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, we're running late. Okay, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kim Brokamp. I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2806 as introduced. I've submitted written testimony to you, so I won't repeat that. For those of you who don't know, staff wellness is a major initiative for us at the Department of Corrections. You've heard from our staff today. We've testified multiple times around the stressfulness of that job. So we hope to be national leaders in our efforts, and we'll continue with that. This bill gives our staff members additional reassurance that coming forward, if they have an issue that requires treatment or counseling, will not be a precursor to losing their job. It helps them protect and know that certification is safe. So with that and the lack of time, I'm going to just let you know I can answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I'm the Director of Professional Standards at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, otherwise known as DPSST. DPSST has also submitted written testimony for committee consideration, but there's a few points that I'd like to expound on very quickly. DPSST is given the statutory authority. I'm sorry.
Please.
Better?
Louder.
DPSST is given the statutory authority to deny, suspend, or revoke the certification of a public safety officer if that officer is convicted of a crime, is discharged from an employment as a public safety officer, falsifies information sent to the department, or fails to meet the minimum standards that have been established by the board, more commonly known as moral fitness standards. Current practice dictates that DPSST opens an investigation when they're notified that an officer has been arrested or has been separated from employment as a result of potential misconduct, for example, a resignation or a retirement in lieu of termination or investigation. House Bill 2806 prohibits DPSST from denying, suspending, or revoking the certification of a corrections officer because they seek assistance with mental health issues, substance abuse, or other counseling needs. DPSST does not currently take action to deny, suspend, or revoke public safety certifications for these reasons alone, absent a separation from employment or an arrest and conviction. Just to give an example, if a corrections officer is battling a substance abuse problem and recognizes the problem and reaches out for help, DPSST would not review that situation. Actually, DPSST would most likely not even be aware of that situation. On the other hand, if an officer is battling a substance abuse problem and gets arrested and subsequently convicted of a DUI, DPSST would review and potentially take action on that officer's certification, regardless if they seek treatment afterwards or not, with the arrest and conviction being the vehicle for review. So in this scenario, the subsequent treatment would, of course, help mitigate that arrest and conviction, but it would not excuse it. In summary, the DPSST and the board appreciate the difference between recognizing a mental health or substance abuse issue and seeking assistance proactively versus reactively, and has structured its certification review process accordingly. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
I just have one. Are you automatically notified if somebody gets arrested that's active?
We do have through the LEDS notification system, Chair.
Anything else? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Eric Skablik, Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, also known as DPSST. Lindsay framed this up very well. Really, this blurs a discussion. It happens quite a bit with our agency, which is employment versus certification. If I work for a public safety agency, whether it's Department of Corrections, a county sheriff's office, and I have a problem with substance abuse, I go in to see my supervisor, my director. That's an employment situation. It'll go to EAP. What we get involved in is a certification, a licensing guide, which is their conduct. So Lindsay framed that up very well. We would not know if an employee is an EAP. That's not our business. That's not our place. So if an agency called and told us that, we wouldn't do anything with it. What we do get is the notification of conduct. So some of the conduct we see, steroids, We were involved in a fairly large investigation with the FBI that involved a number of certified officers involved in steroids abuse that had an issue. We see stolen evidence where they have drug addiction problems. We also see money stolen because they're trying to pay their bills. They have stress-related issues at home. So we see that type of conduct, but we look at the conduct. We do see officers that have been arrested for DUI and convicted, and they have taken ownership of that. They've said, look, I have an issue. I identified it. I'm changing my life. Here's all the documentation of my visits to treatment facilities. And the policy committee and the board have taken that into account and have not decertified those people. But the conduct, what brought them there, is the arrest and the conviction. It's not being stopped for DUI. It's being arrested and convicted. The other thing that I think is important is that we understand the discussion that's happening here with the employees. And I just wanted to take a minute to tell you what we've done over the last 3 years in partnership with not only DOC and the state police, but also the chiefs and the sheriffs, including the fire service, as well as the employees. We have leaned into this issue very heavily. We see the detrimental impact of this stressful job. We see stress across the country up, suicides up. We've dealt with military suicides. We're also dealing with the public safety issues. We've seen at least 5 suicides in the last year. We see a number of alcohol-related incidents. We know there's a number of chapters now of AA, specifically for public safety, the most recent one here in the Willamette Valley. So we want the employees to seek that assistance. But we've also developed a very strong partnership with the chaplains that many agencies use that are counselors and provide that assistance, as well as peer support teams. And we have provided numerous training classes for those peer support teams. The one thing I do want to share is that we invested very heavily in development program specifically for our law enforcement and corrections community called Stress First Aid. This came to us out of the United States military. The Marine Corps and Navy developed this to deal with combat stress first aid, what military members were seeing when they're deployed overseas and what they're dealing with. Not identical to what corrections police officers do, but the same type of skill set, the same type of personalities, the same difficult jobs. We took that group to develop that program. They also developed a program for the fire service, and we asked them to develop a stress first aid for law enforcement and corrections. We have developed that program in partnership with them. We own the curriculum. We've done 2 train-a-trainer classes, have another one coming up next month, and we have at least 45 trainers now that are developing that training, and I'm sorry, delivering it across the state, which is how do we get help to a person the minute they say, I have a problem? Equally important, how do I, as a first-level supervisor, realize that one of my people may have a problem? So we've included it, and it's that important that it's part of our supervision mental management program. So they all get a 4-hour class on recognizing stress and how to deal with it at the lowest level before it gets to the point where there's bad conduct that reaches our agency. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions people may have.
I want to thank you for all the work you're doing over at DPSST. The training is pretty impressive, and it keeps getting better. You know, every time I go over there, I'm more impressed. So
thank you.
Mr. Chair, a very simple question. Does this bill cause you any problems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, quite honestly, we're not sure what this bill is trying to fix. It's not an issue that we're involved in right now.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right, from Department of Corrections perspective with this, and especially with the Employee Assistance Program, I mean, from what I recall, having worked, you know, with state police and everything, we worked extremely hard with folks that were struggling. From my perspective anyways, what's your protocol that you use to follow through if somebody comes to you and I mean, you see they're struggling with mental health?
Chair Barker, Rep Olson, very, very much I would like to think the same way. If an employee comes forward or we start to recognize that one of our employees is having issues, hopefully they've gone through the DPSST mental management training. We refer EAP. All of our managers have EAP cards. We're just starting to learn, you know, gosh, someone is not acting the same. So we really do try. And for us, you know, this bill, again, as Director Gablix has testified to, they're not going to know about people that come up before something happens. And so we're really trying to make sure we're touching those people before something happens that then will impact their certification, which then can impact their employment. Does that help?
Just follow up. Do you have some type of protocol then where, I mean, measures that you follow specifically to walk through with an employee to, you know, where you actually, I mean, I would think that you'd want to be at a point, unless it's extremely drastic, you want to avoid that last episode going into DPSST for decertification.
Chair Barker, Rep. ripples, and absolutely. We that's one of the reasons why I think I talked about that wellness initiative. We try very, very hard to make sure we do not end up in that situation. And I can't tell you we have a formalized process because, again, every situation is individual. We track attendance. We try to keep track of, behaviors and performance. And when we start to see kind of, someone's really not acting themselves, or a divorce is a pretty big trigger for us to recognize some things are going on, that's when we really try to say, okay, is everything okay? But it's not a formalized process.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Let's probably hear open a work session on House Bill 2806.
Chair Barker, I move House Bill 2806 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2806 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none.
Well, no.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
It's an amendment.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm ready to move it without the amendment, unless somebody wants to move the amendment, which would limit they can only have it one time. You don't.
Well, I'm be truthful with you. I'm extremely uncomfortable with this bill.
Okay.
I really am. I think I get it. We just listened to some testimony about exactly what one state agency is doing and trying to assist. For an employee through their programs and everything. I'm not all that convinced that this bill's necessary. I struggle with it.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe today isn't the right day, but I still have some concern. I'd like to be contacted by the pros and cons in my office over the next week where we can have a better discussion and come back and maybe invite just a little more testimony and then make our decision.
Okay. That would greatly help me.
Ignore my motion.
You suspend the rules.
Suspend the rules, and I'm going to undo the work session. We'll go back to public hearing, and then I'll close the public hearing. Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank you.